Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Dan Savage, whose most recent book is Skipping Toward Gomorrah. Dan Savage is also an editor up in Seattle.
That's right.
And columnist in various publications. Dan Savage, first of all, let's talk a little about the book proper, which is subtitled The Seven Deadly Sins in the Pursuit of Happiness in America, which sounds like your title.
Actually, it's actually really arbitrary. I mean, Skipping Towards Gomorrah is obviously a play on Robert Bork's Slouching Towards Gomorrah, which itself is a play on Joan Didion's Slouching Towards Bethlehem, which is lifted from the Yeats poem, The Second Coming. The only part of the Yeats poem that survives now is the word towards. So someone should write a book and drop the word towards and keep skipping in Gomorrah, and then Yeats is completely cut out of it. But I picked The Seven Deadly Sins as a framing device, because if you're going to write a book about sin and sinners and defend them, in America, if you don't have a framing device that lets you know when you're finished, you're never going to be done. And so I just thought that the seven deadlies were a good prism through which to sort of examine American sinners and defend them, which was my goal.
What was the germ of the idea? Just reading the Constitution or something?
Actually, reading Robert Bork's book, Slouching Towards Gomorrah, which I'm just the kind of masochist who would do that.
You actually read the whole thing?
I actually read the whole thing. I read, I have a subscription to the National Review and the Weekly Standard and the Wall Street Journal. I'm kind of a glutton for punishment. But there's a line in Robert Bork's book that leapt out at me, which was, Americans should not be free to choose which virtues to practice or not practice, as that would entail the privatization of morality or the pursuit of happiness as each of us defines happiness. And he lays all this out as deeply problematic and writes this book about how that's pro-censorship, that's anti-everything that I'm for. And he just seems to, the religious conservatives and the virtue grunts and scolds are just so at war with everything that it means to be an American, and no one sort of had the temerity to respond to them in a really specific way, not just saying, oh, you guys are busybodies, which everyone said, but like, oh, you guys are wrong. And, the right, the virtue crowds have so successfully framed the debate that you would believe that, you're either a heroin addict or you're sober, you're either monogamous or you're a whore, and that's just not how it is. Most people exist somewhere in the in-between, and usually closer to monogamy and sobriety than whores and heroin, but in the in-between. And I wanted to write about those sinners, people as I knew them, who indulged in things that Bork and Bennett disapproved of.
So each of these sins, you choose a case study, which we'll go into now, because
okay.
The updates are rather fascinating. The first one you hit on is greed, and that means that you went gambling in both Iowa and in Vegas. Well, one of our favorite skulls, a man named William Bennett, kind of came out of a certain closet.
He did. It was awesome. I had actually written, I started out in Vegas. You're going to do greed, a chapter on greed in America. Why not gambling? Which I picked because it was a sin that never had held any appeal to me. And it is a sin, and Christians regarded it as a sin for, 1,950 years. And then suddenly it became the great American pastime, and it exploded out of Nevada into every country, every state in the Union. And I actually speculated in the book for a couple of paragraphs, like, why has Bill Bennett never condemned gambling? Yeah, I wrote about it in the book. It's in the chapter.
Yeah.
Why has he never condemned gambling? He condemns everything else because of their perceived social costs. And there are social costs to gambling. People get hurt. People do themselves damage, ruin their families. And those are the arguments that he uses against all sorts of other pleasures and vices. But he didn't condemn gambling, and I thought that was so odd. And I said that it was odd, and now we know that he was a gambler. And now, of course, we can assume that anything Bill Bennett hasn't specifically condemned, he's doing. Bill Bennett, he fists. We know it. It has to be true. He's never specifically condemned fisting, so he's an old fister.
If you don't know what it is, this is probably not the place to tell
you. It's a hotel in Milwaukee. It's spelled P-F-I-S-T-E-R, and I'm staying there next week. The Hotel Fister.
I was in Vegas about 3 years ago, and I was absolutely floored by it. I hadn't been there since I was a little kid, and when I was a kid, there were five hotels in the desert, and this thing was just bizarre.
It's Rome. It's a sort of America distilled into this nightmarish circus. You have to go at least once. I expected I would hate it. I never went. I was dragged there against my will the first time because, I looked down my nose on it and thought it was just crass and crude. But the audacity and the spectacle of it and its sheer awfulness is so magnificent. It is the Grand Canyon of bad taste. You really do have to go. Everyone has to go at least once.
What amazed me about it is not that it's just bad taste. It's like bad taste disguised as good taste. Everything is really tasteful now.
Somebody's going to get smart and open a hotel that recreates the 60s, 70s Vegas experience, the Robert De Niro film, sort of. and you know, put up a lot of flocked wallpaper and bad cut glass crystal chandeliers. That'll be the next wave after they get through exploiting the, how, you know, the tasteful thing, the Bellagios and the Venetians, those hotels in Vegas, that was sort of in contrast to what was already there. And now, since the tasteful thing sort of predominates, someone's going to have to create something that's in contrast to tasteful, which is going to be a return to garishness, I think.
What amazed me is that the first day I went around thinking how different everything was. By the second day, I realized everything was the same. It looked different, but it was the same. It didn't matter whether it was the exploding volcano or anything. It was all the same. You walk one place to another, they're all the same.
What I find most appalling are the shopping malls. Like every big hotel has a shopping mall that has all the same stores that are in the shopping mall in your neighborhood, if you live in an urban area, that you can walk to. And you're going to fly to Vegas and go to the Gap. You're going to fly to Vegas and go to like a high-end you know, retail store. My boyfriend, who's a shopaholic, you know, he likes to go to Vegas to go shopping, and I think it's ridiculous. But that, you know, shopping has become the great American leisure activity. More people travel to shop. It's considered a recreation, which is just nuts, I think.
A friend of mine who's an architect said, because I asked him not merely why all the shops were the same, because he's worked in that area, but also why all the malls
look exactly the same.
And he said people like comfort. They like similarity.
Starbucks, McDonald's, the monoculture. Everyone wants to feel like everywhere they go, there it is. It's this comfort zone, which is, I think, identified in the book in the gambling section. I think that's what gambling is really about. People say, oh, people gamble because they're greedy. But everyone knows you lose money when you gamble. So it can't be because you're greedy. It's like you don't flush money down the toilet because you're greedy. And what I think people get in Vegas is almost in opposition to the other thing they get in Vegas. What you get gambling is in opposition to what you get at the Starbucks and all the malls in Vegas that are exactly the same everywhere you go. You get risk and you get danger and you get the unknown. That's why people gamble. Our regular lives are so safe that, you know, but yet in the media and TV and film, we consume risk and danger all the time. We idolize and emulate and style ourselves after these film and TV actors who, every minute that we see them, they're in peril and making life and death decisions. And we never get to do that in our real lives. But in Vegas, $5, we never know what's going to come next in our real lives. Whereas in film, you never know what comes next. In Vegas, five buck chip at a time, you can get some risk and peril and danger for yourself. And I think it was no coincidence after 9/11 that the casinos emptied out. And not just Vegas because people couldn't get there, but because the riverboat casinos, Atlantic City, Indian casinos, they all emptied out because suddenly it felt risky to go to work and get on an airplane and just be an American in America, and you didn't need this risk industry providing it to you in this false way. You know, people were making life and death decisions they felt every day, and as soon as the war on terrorism became this TV show that was more thrilling than our regular lives, the casinos filled back up.
I also wonder if because people have become so accustomed to gambling generally, no matter where you are, that when everybody lost their fortune, you know. And
that's true. That's a very interesting observation. I think that might be true. The reason people were so complacent about the stock market is it had come to be seen as a big slot machine.
Right.
And the crash was just, you know, you roll the dice, you move your mice, and sometimes you lose. Maybe that helped to tamp down the anger.
You know, I was a millionaire yesterday. Today I'm broke. Well, you know, I was a millionaire when I walked into the gambling casino, and today I'm broke.
Right,
I was up a lot and then down. I never spent the money.
The Bill Bennett School of Economics.
There you go. All right, then the next chapter you have is on wife swapping.
Which you're not allowed to say anymore. You're not allowed to use that term. You have to say swinging or play couples because, you know, wife swapping makes it look like the wives are these helpless pawns being passed from man to man. And the wives in the swinging movement, which is a sort of a mass movement of heterosexual adulterers, really reject that and find it very offensive.
Has Bennett specifically condemned swinging?
No, and that's why I chose swinging. He hasn't specifically condemned it at length. In his book, The Broken Hearth, Reversing the Moral Collapse of the American Family, he goes on and on and on about, of course, gay marriage and the threat it poses to straight marriage. And he identifies the threat as the fact that so few gay male couples over the long term are monogamous. And he says, you know, if gay couples are allowed to get married, straight couples are going to get it into their heads that you can be married and not necessarily strictly monogamous. And that's why we can't have gay marriage. And he ignores the organized swinging movement among heterosexuals who are married and non-monogamous. And married already, not hypothetically married at some point in the future, married already, and they recruit. There are websites or magazines or books. Every couple who is involved in the swinging movement, who's straight, was brought into it by another couple who was themselves brought into it by another couple. Everything the religious right and the Bill Bennett's accuse gay couples of doing or gay people of doing, these swingers do. And there's more than a million swinging couples in the United States, which is twice as many married, non-monogamous, heterosexual couples as there would be if all gay men who could get married got married tomorrow. Yet Bennett has nothing to say about swinging. They're the bad example. If you believe that, you know, putting in people's heads they can be married and non-monogamous is going to destroy the family, Bennett should be fuming about swinging. I found a swing club a mile and a half from his front door in suburban Maryland.
You looked?
Yeah, I went and looked for it. And how can he not know? A high-ranking Republican official was outed during the Dole campaign as a swinger and disgraced and left the campaign, and Bennett worked with him. He knows that swinging exists and doesn't want to talk about it. It's much more fun to demagogue around gay people and how we might behave if we could get married, which we can't.
Does he talk about serial monogamy?
No, he doesn't.
Well, gee whiz. So somebody could be serially monogamous, married, divorce, married, divorce, married, divorce.
He doesn't have a problem with that. I mean, Bennett bemoans high divorce rates. And a lot of lefties are upset with some things in my book because I think that people get divorced too easily and for baloney reasons. And especially when there are kids involved, I think that straight couples or gay couples who have kids should suck it up and suffer and try to stay together and patch it up. And forgive each other and make it work for the kids. And, you know, that's kind of a conservative position. So I kind of agree with Bennett on divorce. Except my position then on infidelity is a little different than his. I think that infidelity is so common that people should not use it as grounds for divorce. People should be prepared for it emotionally because it's so likely to happen in a long-term relationship that we should brace people for its almost inevitability. 80% of all long-term relationships and marriages, one or the other or both cheat at some point. Since we know it's inevitable and it's going to happen in most marriages, we shouldn't posit it as this thing that you have to get a divorce to restore your self-esteem. We should posit it as this common occurrence that you should be able to work through and forgive each other for. And that's where, you know, that Bennett doesn't like it when I say things like that. Because it normalizes adultery.
So this means that you and your boyfriend adopted a kid.
That's right.
Right. That means that if you and your boyfriend have real problems, you're going to work very hard to stay together.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've had real problems. It's a funny thing about, you know, being gay and long-term relationship. It's just like being gay and out and telling somebody who's in the closet that he should come out. They say, oh, it's really easy for you to say, as if it was your coming out wasn't hard, too. It's just that you did it and it's over. You know, if you're in a long-term relationship, you know, you get, well, you know, it's easy for you to say. Like, all long-term relationships are stressful and involve a lot of conflict and negotiating and compromise, and ours does as well.
When you're doing the your column, do you get a lot of questions from married gay people?
From gay people who are
or in a partner relationship?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
And what is the general question? Can I cheat on my boyfriend?
No, you get that from straight couples all the time. Gay couples either, you know, they know that they're men, and men are pigs, and men cheat. And I think gay guys who are partnered up, which usually happens in their 30s, because most straight people start dating when they're 10 and 11 and 12 years old. Most gay people don't start dating until they're older. And so they have to make all the mistakes at, you know, 20 and 21 and 22 that their straight friends made at 11, 12, and 13. And everyone has to make those mistakes and learn how to have a relationship. So most gay couples settle down in their 30s. And by that point, I think they have a bit more realistic an attitude, which is not a, you know, cheat on me, get out of jail free card. There's a difference. You know, people, it's that, you know, you're neither monogamous or you're a whore thing. A lot of people, even in the gay world, believe that. I refuse to say that my boyfriend and I are monogamous. That freaks out gay family groups because we have a kid and we're going to have another and we should be saying, oh, we're monogamous in case, you know, Donald Wildman should hear the show. But when I say we're not monogamous, a lot of people, gay and straight, assume that we're having three ways in our house with our kid around and we're, you know, sleeping with other people constantly. And we're not. It's just that we've recognized that the likelihood of us being strictly faithful as men, as gay men, for 50 years, which is how long we'd like to be together, is vanishingly small. So we've set certain parameters where outside things could happen. They're so unlikely. You know, the circumstances under which we have permission from each other and you know, forgiveness in advance, you know, all the moons have to be aligned in such a way that they're so rarely aligned that it almost never happens. So, you know, functionally I say, you know, when I give advice to gay couples or speak to gay groups, it's just, you know, we're non-monogamous, quote unquote, except because of, like, the limitations that we've accepted and we've put on each other, we're pretty much functionally monogamous. But knowing that, you know, you can live in hope that the moons will align and you'll get to see someone else naked every once in a while. And it helps you stay monogamous if you don't have to say you're monogamous, we've found. Right. I think a lot of people in long-term, quote-unquote, monogamous relationships act out in moments that are inappropriate out of despair, because they despair of ever sleeping with anyone else ever again besides their partner. And if you have some certain situations where you know that you could, you can take a pass on bad situations where you have the opportunity, but you really shouldn't.
You're listening to an interview with Dan Savage, whose book is Skipping Toward Gomorrah. Dan, I want to bring in the story of the gay pride and relate it back to this, because an incident happened not long ago to a friend of mine who was invited to be the MC at a gay event in Santa Barbara. And he went down there. He'd gone two CDs called Sex and Mayhem, which were really great.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought him down there. He went down there, and he had figured out routines. And he'd been told to keep the language okay, so he did a little cussing, not a whole lot. But he got complaints, and so he cut it back even further. And then he said, "We're all here to get laid," which is your point in your chapter on Pride and the Gay Day in Los Angeles. Apparently, a straight man with his kids was offended by that. My friend was fired and sent on his way. He went back to the motel to find out that the organizers of the Gay Santa Barbara event had canceled his motel, and they'd changed the key, so he had to have somebody open the door of his room we could get his stuff and leave.
God.
And that happened last week.
That's appalling. I mean, I don't even know what to say to that. There's this, you know, this schizophrenia around gay pride events that, you know, they have this political mission that's about freedom and blah, 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 blah. And then you actually go to them and you look at the way people are actually enjoying them and behaving at them. And what's going on in the crowd, what's going on at the march, is really different than what's going on in the action statement or what's being said by the speakers from the stage. I think it's time to do away with Pride and do away with the notion that the gay Pride parade is anything but a big party. And people go to parties to get laid and have fun, or if they're not looking to get laid, to be in a very hyper-sexual environment where they just feel sort of titillated and alive. And I don't have a problem with that. You know, a gay Pride parade is basically the straight, you know, the gay version of Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras is the straight pride parade. Only happens once a year, and it only happens in one city, and that's too bad for straight people, really. You know, most every culture has a big party where sort of excess and sexuality is celebrated. Even the Germans have Fasching, which is like the German carnival right before Lent, which is a crazy big party with straight people and gay people now out in public acting like, you know, big jerks. And that's good, and people need that release, and gay people get it at the Pride Parade. I just think we shouldn't call it Pride. I think Pride is really damaging.
When I talk to my friend about that, and he's kind of flipped out, of course, and when I talk to others, they're all, like, astonished. They thought this battle was fought years ago. Why should gay people worry about, you know, straight people and their kids being offended? Since when was gay pride a family event?
Well, there's some people who want to make gay pride into a family event. I think there should be a gay family event. I mean, in Seattle, I've advocated for splitting the pride parade in two, because there are people who want to, like, go to the big party and, you know, run around in a jockstrap and a harness in public, or a lime green thong, like one of the guys I wrote about in the pride chapter of my book. And there should be a parade at night. There should be a torchlight parade that's just sort of a bacchanal for those people. And then during the day, the next day, there should be, like, the rally in the park, and that's much more sort of, like, tame for the family values crowd. The gay family values crowd, we're never going to be able to marry, like, the sexual edge of the gay community with the sort of more mainstream people in the gay community. It's a shotgun marriage because it's, you know, oppression and that have thrown us together. You know, I have much more in common with my straight neighbors than I have with, you know, the sex club nutcases who build their lives around sex. And there are people who go to sex clubs who are not nutcases. Even the sex club goers know what I mean when I say the sex club nutcases who build their lives around sex. I have nothing in common with them.
I notice you avoid calling the boys from L.A. circuit party boys, which they are.
They are. They are circuit party boys, and God bless them. You know, for the Pride chapter, you know, how could you avoid, if you're going to do the seven deadly sins, and one of them is Pride, and Pope Gregory the Great called it the Queen of Sin, how could you avoid going to Pride parades? So I went to L.A.'s, and I have a problem with Pride parades, obviously, as all your readers know now. I just think Pride is really damaging. You know, 30, 40 years ago, it made sense. Like, Black Power made sense, and I Am Woman made sense 30, 40 years ago. Now it doesn't make sense. You know, if you were out and gay and reasonably healthy in 1975, that was kind of an accomplishment. You climbed a big mountain. to get there. There is nothing but obstacles thrown in your path from your family and your church and your government, your city. San Francisco even was still arresting gay people in the mid-70s for being gay people. And now it's just not that big of an accomplishment anymore. Maybe you're homeschooled in Oregon without a television set. Maybe you lived and then you came out. Maybe you can point to your sort of coming into your own as a sort of an accomplishment because you grew up in the sort of isolation that all gay people used to grow up in. Now that's just not the case anymore. And yet pride floats around up to this pride ideology that says if it's gay, it's good. If you're gay and you have an impulse, it's good. Don't think about it. Be proud. Why are you? Where's the self-doubt? Why are you? You know, what's this introspection about? Be proud. Don't be self-critical. Be proud. And I think that's really harmful because there's gay people out there who are doing things that they should be deeply ashamed of, and we should be able to make those sorts of distinctions. Gay people giving each other HIV through malice or negligence should be ashamed of themselves. And we have to say that. There's something we can take pride in when you look at the STD rates rocketing back up all over the country. And yet pride has created this sort of inability. We've created this affirmation culture where the only thing that gay people will accept is a rainbow flag waving in their faces. It's making us slow and stupid, and I think it should be put down.
One of the questions that I have about all this is, what is the difference between acceptance and tolerance? It strikes me that gay people will never be fully accepted because that's the culture, you know.
And Jews will never be fully accepted.
That's right.
And blacks will never be fully accepted.
Right.
Full acceptance does not precede enfranchisement or full civil rights. And we should be making that distinction. You know, one of my problems with the gay rights movement is often it seems much more interested in getting a hug from people who don't like us than in securing our civil rights by telling people who don't like us that you can still not like us. It's fine. You can think the Jews are going to hell and let Jews get married and let Jews live in your neighborhood and come to your country club and think they're going to hell and proselytize to them if you care to. But they're citizens just like you, and they have rights just like you that are about citizenship, not about religious faith or belief. And we should be making that argument. The gay community should be making that argument. And some of this endless argument about, you know, what Leviticus says or doesn't say, and, you know, pro-gay Christianity, anti-gay, like, who cares? Like, give people permission to be intolerant. Like, people don't want to let go of their intolerance. That's fine. But we should be treated the same under the law. And you can stay intolerant. You can disapprove of me. I don't want to have dinner at your house. I don't want to come to your church. I just want to, like, make sure my boyfriend can get into the hospital room if I'm in an accident. And usually if you approach even a conservative who really doesn't like gay people on those levels and you give them permission to hold on to their hate, they will give you your civil rights. They can see their way clear. What they're afraid of is they're afraid of mind control, and they're paranoid, and it's irrational. But, you know, they look at what's coming out of the gay movement, what the gay political groups are putting out, which is often this call for let go of your fundamental beliefs and embrace us. And if that's what we put first, that's what we ask for first, we're never going to get our civil rights, our full civil rights. You know, and I don't know any Jews who sit around all day, you know, worried about, you know, reaching out and touching the hearts of people in Aryan nations. They're like, those people are awful and we hate them.
Dan Savage, where is the country going?
Oh, my God. Hell in a handbasket. We got to get George Bush out of there. As The Onion said, in 2000, before the deficit exploded, before the World Trade Center exploded, The Onion did a great headline when George Bush was inaugurated. President Bush, our long national nightmare of peace and prosperity is over.
And it was.
And it was. It was very prescient on the part of The Onion. We've got to get in there and clean up the messes that George Bush is making.
Have you ever been on Fox News?
Yes, I have. I've been on the O'Reilly Factor and Judith Regan Show.
Talk about being on the O'Reilly Factor a little,
oh,
particularly after we know the story of Al Franken.
It's a bit like walking through the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Yeah, I'd never seen it. I don't have cable TV because my grandfather lives in me, and whenever anyone, my boyfriend wants to get cable, I'm like, not paying for television. Four stations is good enough. And so I'd never seen it. I didn't know what his M.O. was, which is to interrupt and keep asking you questions until he finds the question you're not prepared to answer, and then beat you over the head with that question as if it's a stick. And so I was he just shredded me and pulled my kidneys out.
How did he do that?
Well, you know, I've written this book. It was for this book. And,
right.
You know, I'm sort of, people should be able to decide for themselves what they want to do as long as they're not hurting anybody else. And so he threw out the example of gay bathhouses. It's like, well, what about gay bathhouses? And I stupidly let slip how I really feel about them, which is I kind of feel that they're disgusting and unnecessary these days. You know, once upon a time, we needed them because you couldn't have a relationship and stay out of prison. So you needed this anonymous venue to express your sexuality and then slip back into your straight life or your closeted life. We just don't need that anymore. And, you know, Eric Rofus, who I respect and admire very much, makes persuasive arguments about gay male sex culture and its value. But I just, you know, and now especially now with the internet turning every gay man's apartment into a bathhouse, I just think that, whatever. Anyway, I started saying this, and he's jumped on me and said, well, I want to go to a gay bathhouse. Shouldn't be able to pursue happiness in a gay bathhouse? And he's screaming at me. And I was so discombobulated by Bill O'Reilly screaming, I want to go to a gay bathhouse at me over and over again, that I didn't know how to respond. It's a bit like being thrown into a wood chipper going on the O'Reilly Factor, and I don't recommend it.
What about the other one, the Regan show? She strikes me as kind of an idiot.
She is kind of an idiot. A lot of people on the right are not kind of idiots, actually idiots, and malicious, piggish little idiots, too. I got in an argument about pot, because I wrote, for The Sloth, I wrote about pot and marijuana, and I suggest in the book that we should rename marijuana Ritalin and give it to our kids, because, if a teenage boy is going to experiment with a mood-altering substance, better it's pot than alcohol. Alcohol makes you aggressive and stupid, and teenage boys are already aggressive and stupid. It's just fuel on the fire. And marijuana, as I'm sure everyone listening to this radio show knows, blunts, if I may use that expression, blunts those impulses, makes you feel a little less aggressive. And it makes you a little more stupid, but also can expand your mind. And I read this in the book, and she knew I had a kid, and she said, well, you're going to let your kid smoke pot? And I said, not only am I going to let him, on his 16th birthday, I'm going to take him to Amsterdam, and we're going to get high together. And she was appalled that I would do this. But I'm going to do it because one of the things that marijuana legalization does is it makes marijuana not about rebellion. It just makes it about getting high. It strips the James Dean, out of pot use. You can't be a rebel and smoke pot in Holland. You're just stoned. You're just a stoner. And so, you know, people in America, as a countercultural expression of their political dissatisfaction, who don't want to smoke dope, will sometimes smoke dope, whether they're consciously or subconsciously, because it's naughty and bad. The government doesn't want you to do it. I hate the government. I'm going to smoke my pot. And then, you know, places where they have sensible, sane drug laws, people don't have to, they fight the government if they want to fight the government. Then they get stoned and eat Doritos and watch TV Nation.
So you got into an argument. Did you win that one?
Yeah, actually, I think I did better with Judith Regan, because she's not a complete psycho, and Bill O'Reilly is a complete psycho.
What'd you think of the Al Franken story?
Oh, I loved it. Al Franken is awesome. And you know, you watch Bill O'Reilly going around the country, said it in Time magazine. You know, it was 100 years ago, I put a bullet right between Al Franken's eyes. Could you imagine if Al Franken was going around the country saying that about Bill O'Reilly? The howls from the right about the hateful left and the murderous left and the double speak and the hypocrisy is well-established, routine, and still appalling.
I'd like to ask you, you bring up the thing about Ritalin, and I remember last year interviewing Elizabeth Wurtzel,
mm-hmm.
who wrote Prozac Nation, and she made the comment that, in fact, America's children are being hooked to hard drugs right now, and in fact, in high schools, kids are still getting Ritalin, and they're selling it to their friends.
It's amazing. I mean, Ritalin, I agree with the analysis about Ritalin that we've made boyhood in the United States, we've pathologized it. And I've witnessed it with my own son, who's, you know, he's a little straight boy. He likes cars and trucks and bombs and running around in circles until he collapses. And he's got tons of energy. And you put him in a school environment where, you know, the way girls behave, where they can be quiet and organized and focused and they don't need to have a lot of energy to blow off. And, you know, these are generalizations about boys and girls, but they kind of hold true. You know, that is held up as the way all children should behave. And then they look at boys who don't behave that way, and they go, oh, these boys have problems. So, like, let's get them some Ritalin. And it's hugely problematic. I mean, we're the great mood-altering nation. It's crazy that, you know, you can get a Prozac prescription, and Prozac has all these side effects, including destroying your sex life. And, to take the edge off, which is basically what Prozac does. But you're not allowed to smoke marijuana, which does all the same things without the side effects. It's nuts. You know, marijuana, I think, is illegal because corporations can't own it, because people can grow it for themselves. You can't grow Prozac in your yard. You have to go to the pharmaceuticals for it.
I think there's also they want something to hang over people. I mean,
George Soros has said it's basically a way of criminalizing, you know, every adult in the country, because you've either smoked dope or it would be very easy to find dope. Like, you know, people who don't smoke pot, whose kids smoke pot or cousins smoke pot in the house. It's basically, you know, it opens the door to a police state. I don't think we have a police state right now. I reject the left. Like, the left says, oh, it's fascism. We live under fascism. I was on the radio with a woman who's screaming that, you know, we live in a fascist dictatorship. And that sort of rhetoric is tempting, when you don't like the conservatives who are in power, but it betrays a fundamental misunderstanding or political ignorance about what living under fascism is actually like. If we lived under fascism, you and I would be dead already, and we need to not lose sight of that.
On the other hand, there is the idea that they are fascists, I mean, broadening what fascist means, and would just as soon impose that upon us.
But they haven't, which means we're not living under, I mean, that
right, yeah.
That there's fascism, the capability of fascism in American democracy, in the American conservative movement, and in the left, you know, the most murderous fascism that we've seen on the planet was the Soviet Union, which is a lefty sort of atheistic fascism. So it's not just on the religious right or the conservatives. I mean, that the thing about the political circle that eventually gets so far right or so far left you meet. Yeah, that there's fascist impulses, and they have to be fought, and they have to be resisted. Certainly, John Ashcroft, in the right circumstance, would be Hermann Göring or running the Luftwaffe, which is why we have to make sure that those circumstances never present themselves to a John Ashcroft in this country.
Which brings up the question of what do you do about it, other than just, you know, saying, okay, I'll go for Wesley Clark because he has the best chance of winning.
Well, I think you have to go for people who have the best chance of winning. I hope all the Nader voters feel appropriately mortified about what they helped to put into place in this country. I think now we all perceive the difference between Al Gore and George Bush, despite what the Naderites had to say in 2000. You know, when it comes to a big office like president, you know, you want to go with the least bad option. You know, if you want to vote for a plaster saint, vote for your mom. My mom is much better on all the issues than Ralph Nader. I wouldn't vote for her because she has no chance of being president until she runs for school board and gets elected, runs for state rep and gets elected.
Or makes a lot of movies and gets elected.
Makes a lot of movies and get elected. You know, there's always the occasional stunt. There's always, you know, the Jesse Ventura. And look what happened to him. You know, he got in there and flamed out because celebrities don't make good politicians. It's not the same sorts of skills.
You think this thing is a disaster?
I think it's a disaster for the Republicans.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. Governing is harder than demagoguing, as the Bushies have discovered. They're not doing a bang-up job with the economy or the war or social policy in the United States. And they're not going to do well when they have to face the voters again.
What about the role of the media in all that? I mean, we know about the right-wing media.
The right-wing news. There's the right-wing media,
and then there's
the
media.
Mainstream media, which is effectively the right-wing echo chamber. There is a conservative bias in the media. As Eric Alterman wrote, you know, the conservatives work the refs and get favorable treatment. And the media, the mainstream media, God bless them, they think, oh, God, we've been accused of having liberal bias, and a lot of them are liberals. So we have to prove that's not true by, you know, bending over backwards to favor conservative voices, to inoculate ourselves against the church. And maybe if we show them that we're being fair and balanced by over-favoring them, then they'll stop making these accusations against us. But of course they won't, because it gets them this favorable treatment. I know promoting this book that I was, you know, approached by radio shows and cable shows, including on NPR, about coming on, only if Bork or Bennett would go on with me. And when Bork or Bennett said no, I wasn't on, effectively handing Robert Bork and William Bennett a veto over whether my book would be discussed on these shows. And of course they use the veto. When Bork or Bennett has a book out, they don't come to me and say, you can go on with them or we're not having them on.
That's standard operating procedure in the mainstream media.
That's
you
right.
could have a normal point of view that 90% of the people will agree with, and they'll find the one nutcase.
Yeah,
on
everything
the other side.
Has to be presented as if it's 50-50, as if
right.
the nation is polarized and divided down the middle. That's fair when you present it like that. And it's actually created polarization, I think, often on issues where there isn't gun control. 70-80% of Americans are all for gun control. Everything that the, you know, gun-free America folks want, everyone's for. Trigger locks and gun safety laws and registration and training and closing the gun show loophole. And you would think, looking at the mainstream media, that it's a deadlock. But it's not. It's a runaway.
Well, what's happened to you when you wind up on one of those shows and you're winding up someone who says, kill all gays? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Oh, I laugh at them. I was recently on I was on Politically Incorrect a while ago, before the show got canceled, with the head of Stop Homosexuality International. You know, they don't believe it. If he believed that homosexuality was everything that he was saying, it was threat to the American family and the end of democracy, the fall of Rome, he wouldn't go on a late-night jokey TV show and trade quips with a fag. He just wouldn't, you know? And I don't think that they take it seriously. And oftentimes when you scratch a conservative blowhard, there's a person not too far underneath the surface winking at you going, I'm just doing this for a living.
Yeah.
And you know, they play to their constituency, and they play to the peanut gallery, and when they feel like they're losing the spotlight, they reinvent themselves just like an actor. Politics is, they say, you know, it's Hollywood for ugly people.
So should we trust someone like Arianna Huffington then?
No, Arianna Huffington is an opportunist and a freak. And, you know, nobody took her seriously. Nobody on the left I knew took her seriously and was, like, rushing out to vote for her. People like the things that she's saying now on the left. But, you know, her sincerity has to be called into question. And, you know, I've had friends who reinvented themselves every 6 months or every year or two who aren't my friends anymore because it got so exhausting trying to keep up with who they are now and having to buy off on this is who they really are and have always been and the person they were last 6 months ago when they told you this is who they really were and had always been. You know, was discarded. It's just too, and that's what Arianna Huffington is like. It's just another there. She's just an onion. She keeps peeling herself. And right now she's saying things you agree with, but you know, or you intuit that 2 years from now she'll be completely reinvented, saying things you don't agree with anymore. So you don't buy off on Arianna Huffington. Buy off on some of her ideas right now, but her personally, I wouldn't have voted for her.
I remember several years ago interviewing William Safire, and we went head to head, and it was actually fun because I kind of won. After that,
I enjoy William Safire's column.
After that, I ran into John Dean here at KPFA, and he said, well, you talked to Safire. Do you think he actually believes what he's saying? I thought about it, and I realized not a chance.
Not entirely, not all the time, no.
No. And he said, I didn't think so either. And this is a guy who was writing Nixon's speeches. You know, this is the guy who came up with nattering nabobs of negativity. Dan Savage, you also edit a newspaper, a magazine. Is that an alternative?
It's an alt-weekly in Seattle. It's the biggest alt-weekly in Seattle. There are two, the Seattle Weekly and The Stranger, and we're bigger, and we've kicked their butts.
How do you manage your time between the family, that, writing books, and the column?
My boyfriend's a stay-at-home parent.
Really?
And doesn't have a job. We're privileged to live the way people lived in the 50s. Heteronormative is what my gay radical friends call my relationship. Because, you know, I'm getting paid to write these books and stuff. And so right now he can stay at home. I mean, I'm a total workaholic and don't budget my time well. But I have certain, you know, he puts certain limitations on me. There's no computer in our house anymore, so there's no checking email at home and trying to work.
You can't work at home now.
No, I'm forbidden.
What are you working on now? Obviously, it's 2 years since you wrote this book.
Well, I took some time off and just did my two full-time jobs instead of three, which is what it is when I have a book on my plate, too. But I just signed another book deal. I'm actually going to write about multi-generational households, which sounds like a weird topic for me. But I grew up in an apartment building, just two apartments, a two-flat they're called in Chicago, that my great-grandparents built and raised their family in, that my grandparents raised their family in, and that my parents raised us in, 4 generations in this house. And I want to write about that world, how it disappeared one day in about 1976. The idea of, you know, you see things now with the economic bust, courtesy of the Republican Party. You see things written about, you know, adult children moving back in with their parents and bringing their children. And it's always discussed as if this is unheard of in the whole course of human history, that a grown-up would live with his parents and his children, when this is actually how people lived for the first 50,000 years of human history. And it was an aberration that non-multi-generational houses. And I think much of what American misery can be traced back to, you know, the disappearance of multi-generational households. A lot of American misery can be traced to it as well. You know, there were downsides to it. The presence of your family and your parents and your house is very smothering. However, it's also very freeing. You know, we, you know, had childcare all the time. There was always aunts and uncles around. There was always grandparents there. There was always almost your parents in a multi-generational household become not the Supreme Court and not the Death Star, which is what we started calling my parents after the Star Wars movie came out, because you sort of had an appeals court in the persons of your grandparents or your aunts and uncles who could reason with your parents when they were being a bit psychotic, which, you know, being Irish Catholic, my parents were frequently psychotic.
So is this going to be more autobiographical, do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to tell the story of my family and the story of this kind of life by telling the story of this apartment building. It's sort of a departure, or a return, if you will, to the kid, in a way.
Dan Savage, how did you become a columnist, a sex columnist?
By accident. A lot of people, especially all these kids now who are writing their sex columns in their college papers, want to be sex columnists when they grow up. It's really hard to get a sex columnist gig that pays in regular newspapers because, first of all, someone with a successful advice column does not retire the way someone writing for a college newspaper graduates. So it's not like there's a gig opening every couple of years. My column, like Ann Landers, will be pried from my cold, dead hands one day. But I met some people who were starting a newspaper, and they asked me, we were just joking in a bar in Madison, Wisconsin, and they told me they're in a newspaper, and I said, oh, have an advice column, because everybody hates them, but everybody reads them. I know I did. And they turned it around on me and asked me to write an advice column for their paper, which it sounds really disingenuous 12 years later, but I wasn't angling for the gig. I'd never written anything in my life. And it's clear if you read the first couple years worth of columns that I had never written anything before in my life when I started writing Savage Love.
Did you do a lot of research? Or did you just kind of make stuff up?
Made stuff up and winged it. I still wing it and make stuff up all the time. I don't take it very seriously. I don't think an advice column is there to help anybody. And I'm not as interested in sex as the average sex writer is supposed to be. I think sex is overrated and sometimes boring.
One final question. Is there a deadly sin that is never listed as a sin at all?
Funny thing is, the deadly sins aren't deadly sins anymore, really, when you think about them. The greed, pride, sloth, gluttony, lust, envy, anger, and whatever. They're really American virtues. These are the animating features of human life, which is why the Catholics tried to make them sins. It was a way of criminalizing and making into sin every human impulse so that you were always dragged back into the confessional, into the church. These things, so long as you don't lose yourself in lust or lose yourself in gluttony, these are positives. They fill your life with meaning. You know, I think the deadly sin today is fundamentalism, is an inability to give the other person the benefit of even a small doubt and saying, you go live how you want to live, this is how I want to live, and I'm not going to try to impose my life on you, for the deal being you don't impose your lifestyle on me. And just the fact that you exist is not an imposition on me. You know, when you hear people demagoguing about the gay lifestyle, it's as if the fact that we're out there is an imposition, and it's not. If I was in your house telling you to, forcing you to live my lifestyle, that would be an imposition.
You've been listening to an interview with Dan Savage, whose most recent book is Skipping Toward Gomorrah. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.